Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled.
Film
Conversation.
Hooray! Woo!
The only podcast where Richard Nicholas, Abigail Bain, Anthony Evans all talk about a film together. We are Filmbin.
Hi.
Say hello.
Hello.
Hi.
So, you know, this week we've got another film to talk about. That film is 24 Hour Party People. And it was picked by Abby, so she can give you some of the details. So you're on the same page as us.
24 Hour Party People is from 2002. It was directed by Michael Winterbottom, written by Frank Cottrell Boyce. It has a lot of people. It's quite an ensemble piece, but I've elected to point out Steve Coogan, Shirley Henderson, Paddy Considine, and Andy Serkis.
Oh, I feel bad for people like John Sims and Peter Kay, who've left off the list.
But as you say, it is the song.
There is too many. There's not too many, but it would be indulgent of us to bang on about who the whole cast is.
But that's the one. Individually, no doubt.
Indeed. We'll talk about them nevertheless. So, seeing as it's your pick, Abby, what were your reasons for picking it and your expectations going into watching this film?
I saw this film a fair while ago, haven't watched it for quite a bit, had fond memories of it, decided to put it forward again. I have a general like for films that cover sort of little bubbles in time is the only way I could think of talking about it, where 24 Hour Party People is about that bubble that happened in Manchester where various elements coalesced, a movement happened, and then it all went wrong and broke down again.
Yeah, because Manchester, at least, likes to cultivate this idea that they were a big part of the music industry in Britain and a significant player between about, like, late 70s to, like, mid-90s, which this is about.
Mm.
And they're not necessarily wrong. They, you know, some good acts have come out of Manchester. But, you know, what were you expecting on the rewatch, then, if you already liked it? Surely you just had that feeling of I can't wait.
Well, not I can't wait so much as, well, all right, the first time.
I mean, I liked it anyway. I enjoy the performances and I like a lot of the bands in it. And I think that's kind of key. If you like the music acts that it is about, you know, that'll make it easier to enjoy. Unless you're really fastidious in your facts and you didn't like the indulgences, perhaps, when it goes away from factual truth. But, if you like the music, it's a help. But otherwise, it's full of really great British actors and comedy actors all doing little parts in this sort of biography about a music producer / presenter who we're going to talk about because it's about him, played by Steve Coogan in this case. So, yeah, I mean, I liked it. I expected I would like it this time. So there was no surprises for me. Anthony, what about you?
Well, this was my first time, unlike you guys. Mm. So I heard of the film, and I only really heard good things about it. But for me, there's always the kind of Steve Coogan factor, where he's a bit hit or miss for me. So
he can
kind of ruin a film, if you know what I mean, or he can kind of make it. So there's always that coming in. So I didn't really know whether I would like it or not, even though it's, well, quite critically acclaimed.
Hmm.
Well, you're right about Steve Coogan. He is, when he's good, he's really brilliant. There's some tremendous like things he's in that I think where he's just on form. Like some people might argue Alan Partridge is probably his best known stuff, but I don't know. I think recently he's done The Trip, which is a British kind of four documentary comedy thing with Rob Reiden, and they're both brilliant in that. And just generally, Steve Coogan can be really funny and a great performer and actor. And then other times, it is like nails on a chalkboard, mainly because the comedy will be terrible. Like I wouldn't necessarily blame him because stuff like what's that one with Jackie Chan, Around the World in 80 Days?
Yeah,
you guys seen that?
I have.
No.
Yeah.
So there's stuff like that as well. So I think I get where you're coming from, like not knowing which Steve Coogan you're going to get. But, you know, did you get on with it, more or less?
Yeah, I did actually really like the film.
And I guess another crucial element to ask you is the bands that are in it. Did you know anything about them before you watched this, or did you care for any of them that were in the mockumentary?
I'd heard of all pretty much all of like the big kind of players in the film, I suppose. There's like a long montage like at the beginning somewhere. And yeah, I've heard of most of the people and their music. And well, not a huge part of what I listen to. I live in the UK. I've been exposed to the music before a lot.
Mm.
I like a Happy Monday or a Joy Division from time to time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Abby, what is your relationship to the bands and musicians that it portrays?
I don't know how, but it was a portion of music that I got into fairly significantly during my teenage years, even though it was past the time, because I was a teenager in the 90s, but in the 90s where this had just passed and been.
Not quite old enough to have been in the clubs and going to the illegal raves and things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I really liked the actual... I didn't know that much about it in terms of the history and the way that it worked, but the music itself I was quite familiar with and I liked.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I'm a big Joy Division fan. Possibly because of this. I think this might have got me more interested. I mean, they're very, dark and depressing and weird to some extent. But, they have such atmospheric music, it's kind of compelling, I find.
Mm.
The Happy Mondays, less so, but there, there's the odd, bit of dancey stuff that isn't too bad of theirs. I mean, it's all, kind of club dance music, but there's one or two things. And then some of the other bands that sort of touched in the story, like The Clash or, not Simply Red, not them, not a fan of Mick Hucknall. But there was a few connections that I like as well. But for the most part, I like Joy Division the most, so it was interesting to hear about them. And I'm on board with the sort of, the bands that are in it. I think that could be a big clincher, because if this film spends a lot of time singing the praises, figuratively, of the bands, and it sort of makes them out to be geniuses and poets, and if you don't like them, you'd be like, oh, what are you talking about? You kind of would find yourself at odds with the message of the film, which is there was this magical, amazing time where Manchester was, so influential in the music industry in Britain and stuff. And you might find that a bit, no, the Happy Mondays are annoying and Joy Division are depressing and all the other bands are rubbish. You know what I mean? That might be a problem. And I might have been interesting if one of us had not been that on board with the bands to see how we feel, but...
Yeah, maybe you're right. Because the music is the film, really.
Mm.
It's like, it's always there. You're always aware of it. And it's such a big part of the whole film, really. Yeah, I think you're right there. It could be a clincher in that regard.
But it does focus on, a TV presenter and producer who is basically telling his account of the time, of his success being like a club runner and a producer of these bands, and he's basically telling his own legend, in a sense. And it does a great job of breaking the fourth wall and letting you in on the fact, like talking directly to you, that he breaks from character. Oh no, he stays in character, but he talks directly to the audience from time to time and references the fact that, obviously, this is a film. These are actors playing the roles. And some of this is lies and made up so that, we want to print the legend kind of thing rather than adhere to strict facts, which is really weird for a kind of biography to do, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but I think that works really well. Because constantly from the start, it's telling you pretty much that don't take this with a pinch of salt. And you really kind of need to, because like the film gets very fantastical at some points. Well, not so much. I'm making it sound a bit fairy tale, but you know what I mean. Like it stretches believability sometimes. Like really, they were all here.
And other things, like, there's one point where he kind of establishes some of this isn't quite true. And it's in one of the scenes in one of the clubs. Yeah, so Tony Wilson is in, like, one of the toilets and is, like, kind of the first sort of act, but later on in the first act, he's confronting his wife, who is with a member of the Clash. And then as he like, talks to her and they're kind of doing it in the stall and he leaves, they pass by a janitor who is actually the guy that's allegedly, you know, like, the guy from the Clash is the janitor, and they basically says, I don't remember this happening. And they clarify with Steve Coogan's voiceover saying that, yeah, some of this might not be true, but, you know, print the legend, basically, is what he says, isn't it? He kind of, they tell you, we're sometimes lying. And that's really odd. And it's nice to do it with the man they're lying about in the film in a different role. It's very odd. Like, I think generally, Abby, one of the good things about this film is it feels like it's done in a way that appeals to the audience. It's a kind of youthful film, and it feels like it's about anti-culture or subculture, I guess, not anti-culture. It's about subculture, and it feels a bit like it's trying to appeal to a younger demographic. Like, it's for youth to enjoy and to learn or to reminisce if they're, you know, the right age to remember this stuff happening.
No, yeah, definitely. And it's just that sort of putting all their cards on the table early on meant that you could watch this and sort of, it's more about the feel and emotion of what was happening at the time than the actual facts of what happened at the time.
Yeah, the trials and tribulations that, you know, the producers had to go through, or the bands, or just, you know, it's a slice of the experience that Tony Wilson took away from it, I guess. And I think one of the key things to it being an interesting film as well is, because it's about Tony Wilson and Steve Coogan's playing him, it's funny. It's meant to be, like, he kind of mocks himself. He doesn't portray himself in an overly positive light. He's always saying how he was never the genius. He was just trying to make things happen. And he puts all the talent on the artists and is often portraying himself as it's kind of like a version of Alan Partridge in it, because, you know, you can't help but make that comparison with Steve Coogan. But it's kind of like he's the butt of a lot of the jokes and a bit pathetic at times. And he's played as if Tony Wilson is a lame guy, but he feels he's a part of it. So that's okay, you know.
Well, one of the through jokes that I liked was his relationship with his agent, who kept getting him, because he was a news reporter or a journalist of some kind.
Yeah, he kind of did little light topics throughout this film, and generally he was a presenter, yeah.
So all of the TV work he was getting as a journalist was really naff. He went to a zoo at some point, and there was an elephant being spray cleaned by a midget.
A baby elephant?
It's a baby elephant. But still, that isn't a story. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and then, like, hand gliding and meeting, you know, odd people and doing quite lame TV, like, light entertainment segments, as well as producing a late-night music show, all of it for, like, Granada, which was, like, a TV production company that did a lot of stuff for ITV. It's kind of intercuts the story of essentially two main bands and their kind of rise to success under the label of Factory, which is Tony Wilson's, you know, famous production thing. And it's his story of him meeting the band, signing them, getting them, like, basically them getting fame, notoriety, and then where their story goes from there and what happens next, and you know, the scene they kind of create, isn't it? So, and it's good that it has these contextual scenes where it's basically him jobbing as a presenter and being lame but funny and sort of trying to tie it in with the whole overarching story he's trying to tell from his perspective.
And I suppose it'd be kind of interesting because they're so kind of out of character. Those moments where he's doing, like, the TV things seem kind of like a bit removed from, like, his actual self within the film, like his music industry self. But like, I suppose the weird thing is that that's how the mass majority of people would have seen him, like who are watching this film and know about him, would know about him through the TV. So it's an interesting kind of juxtaposition between the two. And just like a funny little moment as well to kind of break it up.
Yeah, because he's a very, you know, seen guy. He knows, you know, he's on the pulse of the music scene in Manchester and is, you know, he's in the trenches a lot of the time seeing the bands. And he's not like a hands-off producer. He's just in a position where he's, you know, got enough money coming in for TV to make a living, but also to fund some of the stuff they're doing. But it's also about his mismanagement a lot of the time. The bands that he signs don't make any money because they have fairly informal contracts, and he tends to overspend on the venues they buy and the offices and the stuff that they decorate the offices with. Like, it's kind of painting him to be passionate but kind of messing things up as well, being an idiot. Yeah. What did you guys make of Steve Coogan playing Tony Wilson then? Because that's, you know, the through character. Did you enjoy Steve Coogan? Did you, like, feel or think anything about Tony Wilson off the back of this or whatever?
Yeah, I think he hit, like, a nice kind of mark where he's got his kind of easy, sarcastic kind of, like, demeanor, you know what I mean? And that really kind of fits in well with the actual character because he's such a bit of a git. Is the cleared term right?
Yes.
You can say that. So yeah, I think he strikes up a nice balance, and there's nice comedy moments. There's a few like drama moments that he has. And I think, yeah, it just kind of works in this one.
Yeah, he's like a different kind of, I don't know, like, sorry. Go on, sorry.
I was just going to say, he still has that kind of, like, self-importance as well, that kind of, like, Aaron Partridge does.
Yeah, he kind of plays it like a different variation of Alan Partridge, the sort of, you know, Granada-employed presenter who's a bit of an ass, but also is passionate about his project. So, you know, and he wants to portray an image of himself, you know, outwardly to kind of say, look, I'm a success. But at the same time, it's not his ego running away with him. It's just the way he is. He's not like, he's not a villain. He's just kind of, I don't know. He kind of mismanages a lot of the time and does things wrong. And also, one of his problems is when you're dealing with, you know, alternative musicians and their lifestyles, they're often a problem, like whether it's they're dark and depressed or or whether they're drugged up maniacs who are binging to excess on every kind of thing going, you know, like they see, like it's a very difficult thing to tame of these, you know, wild alternative bands and groups. Abby, what did you make of Steve Coogan in this role?
Steve Coogan has always had and will always have that perfect voice for someone who sounds like they know what they're doing, but don't.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's one of the things that sort of divides people, but it's one of my things that, if used properly, it is one of the strongest elements of his performance.
That kind of confident but feckless thing, isn't it?
Yeah, just fronting it out all the time, constantly. Even if he's doing things correctly, still fronting.
Amazing. Which I think for the sort of the Tony Wilson that they're portraying in this is sort of right. I don't know much about the real bloke, you know, but it feels like the way the script is and the way he narrates, Steve Coogan feels like a fitting choice for the way that the writers have portrayed this idea of who Tony Wilson was and who Tony Wilson thought he was and stuff. And you know, it's all from his perspective, and yet we get some really interesting looks into how these bands formed and work together and deal with different situations. So should we talk a little bit about some of the story arcs of the bands that we cover? I guess it's mainly Joy Division for the first half, going into New Order, and then the Happy Mondays, and kind of the downfall of Factory Records by the end, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I get, like, Joy Division, who were some of the people who play them? We've got John Sims, Ralph Little, who's the lead singer? I love that guy in loads of stuff, and I don't know his name. He's cracking in the Borgia TV series.
Oh, yes! That's what I remember him from. Thank you, Rich.
The ginger-faced assassin. He's in loads of dark, British, gritty dramas. And I always go, oh, that guy. I think he's in Ashes to Ashes as well, Abby, which you are a fan of. I am a fan of. That's great.
His name is Sean Harris. He's playing Ian Curtis.
Yeah, Sean Harris. Right. So, he's got a tough role to play because... that's essentially a character who eventually has reason, in his own mind at least, to commit suicide, and is from a particularly dark band anyway. Like, they kind of got some depressing imagery and concepts to their music.
Yeah.
So it's a very hard, challenging role.
I thought he was really good. He really kind of channeled the kind of kinetic energy that Ian Curtis supposedly had.
Mm.
And then just a very odd performance. I really liked it. It really stood out.
Yeah, you could totally buy that this guy's got some, like, something going on behind the eyes. Because there were some times where he seemed fine and, like, there was a suggestion that maybe he's a bit depressed. You know, like, he didn't outright say anything was wrong. Like, he suffered from epilepsy occasionally. And he seemingly had a relationship problem that they didn't go into very much, but you could tell that there was something wrong, even though they don't overly clarify it, and that I think that's about right for Ian Curtis. I mean,
they don't kind of seek to kind of answer any questions about him, really. It's more just kind of like, he was here when it happened, and this is kind of our experience.
Yeah, there's another film actually called Control, which is about Ian Curtis and Joy Division and stuff, which is kind of like, let's take another look at this story from, you know, a different director, a different writer. And I don't really want to review that, but that's a good one to go to if you want to fill out your Ian Curtis fandom. But I thought this was a good interpretation. And it really showed the band as being, like, they didn't seem like a cohesive all buddies band. Like, Ralph Little was quite cold and heartless in his role, and there was quite a lot of like abuse between them and their own fans sometimes, and a kind of like, they kind of highlighted that at every gig you don't get adulation every time. Sometimes,
yeah,
you know, you get rotten skinheads who were more up for a fight and stuff. What do you guys make of some of the other characters other than, like, you know, Ian Curtis's role?
Well, I suppose at this point you also have Andy Serkis's character. Abby? Name?
His name was Martin Hannett.
Supposed genius. I don't know much about him, but under the opinion of Tony Wilson, who was bullied in the film, a lot by this man, still regarded him as a genius. I mean, this is a guy who seemingly attempted to kill him at times and was quite cross. And yet, Tony Wilson still gave him his dues and his credit for being a genius when it came to, you know, recording and producing the albums and stuff the bands recorded.
Yeah. And Andy Serkis, it was quite a small role, but I think one that stood out.
And then later on, quite a fat role.
Yeah.
Well, I think that hair particularly, he's just kind of oddly intimidating, even though he's quiet and he's kind of a disrespectful, harsh man, but intimidating as well, without really doing anything but looking a little bit like an odd Slash figure.
I get the feeling, this is based on nothing but my own sort of notions, that Andy Serkis takes a great deal of pleasure out of looking really terrible in some of the things he's in.
I mean, Gollum looks awful, but I know what you mean. Like, the rough and horrid characters are more interesting sometimes, I think. Yeah, and you've got the whole story of Joy Division being managed by Tony Wilson and him sort of writing a blood contract with them and trying to prove, almost trying to prove to them that he's committed to what they want, and kind of proving he's cool enough to hang and do something with them. And yet at the same time, there's other managers of Joy Division. There's
Paddy Considine, and Lenny James was playing Alan Erasmus. Is that the right person?
I don't know. Maybe? I don't, yeah. But anyway, Paddy Considine is a rather interesting character. Again, he's got that kind of slightly intimidating element to him. Like, there's lots of characters that are kind of, at any moment, they could pick a fight and it wouldn't go well. Like, you know? And there's Tony Wilson has to deal with the other managers of Joy Division and work with them, and kind of they're all like a kind of team that are trying to make money and promote the records that they make and get people interested in coming to the venues and stuff. And it kind of creates an interesting dynamic. And then we're kind of learning about, you know, this band going along with, you know, any venue or gig that they got going and trying to generate some interest, but generally being treated like they're talented and successful, and it's not really about will they, won't they. It's a case of they're great. How can we make this work? You know.
But that's the thing. Tony Wilson's heart was in the right place the wrong time, but his brain was just wrong again and again and again. Where he had all of this talent, and he just mismanaged it utterly the whole time.
But then some of it was circumstances. Like, I'm thinking of when they're talking about, like, because as things build throughout the film, they get more success, they're able to rent or buy better venues. And they end up, you know, with a small pub deal, like with Peter Kay plays a landlord of a pub. And it's a fantastic job because he's so horrible, and like he's just right because he's that kind of weird Bolton Manchester kind of guy, and he's like he doesn't really care about music; he's more about making money, and he's just and his coat and his turtleneck and how did you guys find the Peter Kay element of the film?
He's just one of those characters that sort of popped up, and it was like it felt more like a crossover to me. Then he was a character just for this. I felt like that was a character that Peter Kay would do, and it just so happens they've crossed over in this.
Like in a more dated version of Phoenix Knights or something.
Yeah.
Like it's just one of Peter's ideas for a role, a kind of grubby, horrible landlord who, like a publican who just was seedy and wrong. And there's some good incidences with him. Like he's got this horrible van that they see Ladies of the Night in, and it's full of like plush carpeted walls, and it's just some of the most moments of the film. But what I was saying, I think, was they have Factory One or Fac One or whatever, and they have that venue, and then later they have the Hacienda, the kind of legendary club that Manchester is still proud of to this day, despite it not being a thing anymore. And part of the story says, well, one of the problems with all the money at that time was not being made by the bar or like on the door paying to get in. It's the drugs, you know, like people are spending all their money on ecstasy and other like drugs to take off the evening. And that's you know, all that money is controlled by drug dealers, and then drug dealers equal crime. And so they kind of talked about how they get around it by making the drug dealers security so that there's no problems with police raids or whatever. And, the drug dealers patrol, you know, kind of keep it to themselves, but they also get all the money themselves and take a significant, you know, profit away from what should have been a profitable endeavor for, you know, Tony Wilson and his group of, you know, people. So that was one of the examples where Tony Wilson isn't really to blame. He can't help that the culture means the illegal thing is the thing that makes all the cash.
Mm.
Did you feel sorry for him, or did you feel, well, tough in it, you know? Did you feel sympathy at all?
There's a lot of the film, I don't think they're trying to make him look particularly sympathetic.
Hmm.
Because generally that's not as funny, I guess.
Yeah. It's funnier to see someone trying to beat him up because he bought a ridiculous long wibbly wobbly red table that's hooked to the ceiling in their ridiculous expensive office, isn't it? That's funnier than someone doing a good job.
Yeah, but the kind of technique they use where he's constantly kind of like addressing the audience and reminding us that it's, you know, a kind of made up film. And I think there's a moment where they kind of really just kind of skip over his second wife and like he has a kid. So there are kind of moments. Actually. There are kind of little moments that they're trying to put in where it's kind of, okay, we have to kind of give him a bit of kind of sympathy. But like, I suppose a lot of it comes up when he's just kind of wrapped up in things and things are just kind of going wrong for him. And where you start to kind of feel a bit more sorry for him.
Yeah.
Well, there were a few moments in the film where they had to make a choice where what they're making this film about versus stuff that happened that you can't really just pretend didn't happen. For a good example of it is that he got married again and he had children, or a child at least. But because, like he said in the film, it's not about him, it's about the whole situation that they were all in together, then it's a small detail that would be weird if you pretend it didn't happen, but at the same time isn't really relevant either.
Yeah, and one of the great get-outs for any moment where you kind of question why they've missed stuff out is, you know, they speak to you, they tell you why, and he gives you sometimes a pretentious, sometimes a funny take or a narration that, you know, tells you why we're doing, you know, this part of the story and why we've emphasize this bit and not this bit. And I think that really works. I think it's one of the things that makes it such a engaging and funny film is you've constantly got these moments where someone can turn to camera and talk to you or narrate over it in the appropriate way, and it's all from the voice of Steve Coogan, so it all feels like a one long good idea throughout. And I think it works really well.
Yeah, especially with the kind of the cinematography that it has, where it really kind of captures that kind of low quality, cheap kind of like handycam kind of feel to it. Like, this is one of the better looking kind of mockumentaries I've seen because it literally looks how it should, if you know what I mean.
It feels so dated, but appropriately dated. Yeah,
yeah. So that kind of like adds in, and I suppose that that's kind of a response to the kind of the music that the film's about. Like, it's all very kind of rough and grungy and punk and new wave. And it kind of fits in, the cinematography kind of fits in with that kind of style of music, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And they use the music and the musicians they're talking about very well throughout. It feels like each chapter has the right music of the right artist. I mean, it's easy because it's, you know, play the music of the band that it's about, but it has little bits of bands that aren't in it very much. It makes small references, and it sort of highlights where, oh, look, there was some famous people connected to this bit of the story, and oh, look, here's Iggy Pop in this bit, and here's a reference to, you know, Mick Hucknall here, and The Clash, or whatever, or the Sex Pistols. They're briefly at a Sex Pistols concert that's that kind of legendary one where there's, like, 44 people who were actually there, and yet everyone claims they were there when they first played, and it actually points out to you who in the room. Like, it's like they tell you all the famous people in the room, and then they tell you, there's also a postman. He's just a postman, but he's at all these gigs, and, you know, it kind of deflates that idea that everyone can be at these special things. Sometimes they're underwhelming, and there were people who were there, and there's people who weren't there, and they're still magical and important to music, but they're not as tremendous as people make out. I think it tries to, you know, give us this weird world in a very alternative way, in a very cool way, but also in a realistic way. And that's a combination of the visual style with the storytelling that does all that. I think it's really quite a creative film. The second half, then, should we say, is about the Happy Mondays. And they touch upon Sean Ryder growing up in his little Manchester flat, talking to like his brother and his dad, and watching TV and eating their dinner in front of it, and you know, the influences he had being a little weirder than you might expect. Like, he gets influence from this weird like, what's this guy on TV that they're watching? And he goes, look at this guy, he's mental, because he's got this strange, weird voice.
I forget the name.
Anyway, it's like a weird guy. You wouldn't expect to be an influence on them. And then they later explain how he actually appeared in a concert with them one time. And it gives us the seeds of the story of the Happy Mondays. And then later, the second act is kind of, okay, Joy Division has come to an end, and they've had to become New Order just because, you know, Ian Curtis has committed suicide, just as they're getting to the point where they could tour America. And it's just as their success could be coming and they'd be snowballing to greater heights. It's just at that point where Ian Curtis commits suicide and kind of throws everyone off, and it's kind of like a shock and, you know, reevaluation.
Yeah, for a typical film, like it would have stopped now. Like, there's an obvious progression where, you know, they get famous and then they hit like the peak and then it's only downhill from there, kind of thing. But then because it is inspired by true events, like, that's not the story. And then it kind of, the film has to kind of change then for its second act. I think like Steve Coogan at some point references, like, this is a film of two acts and now it's the second half is starting. And it's just kind of interesting because you kind of, from conventional point of view, you wouldn't kind of see that coming, and like essentially how the second half is kind of totally different from the first in that regard, how it's totally about a different set of people.
Well, because it's Tony Wilson's story, and Tony Wilson went on living and producing and doing stuff, and the music scene continued and evolved. Whereas, though the Joy Division story ends, New Order also keep going, but it's not even about how after Joy Division, New Order happened, because New Order are just part of the production team and are responsible and are keeping the Hacienda afloat with their money that they're making. But it stops being about them. It doesn't keep being about John Sims
It never, the film, like I think we said, the film never kind of truly focuses on any one kind of person or band or thing, or never kind of seeks to answer really any questions about them. They're just kind of showing you, like, here's some stuff that happened.
Yeah, because we basically finish off that chapter by having Curtis's funeral, and weirdly we get a Simon Pegg cameo out of nowhere. Like, this is back when he wasn't like the megastar he is now, but he's just there at the funeral as like a journalist or something.
His occupation is journalist, but he's actually there as a fan.
And
weirdly, Tony Wilson starts saying, no, you have to write about this. You can't not write about this. Look at this. Look, here he is.
Like, yeah. And it's really weird how they go into the small room where Curtis is, like, in his open casket in white. And I think his grandmother or someone is there. And it's just that kind of awkward, what do you do in this situation, funeral? And, like, the fans are all outside being kept out. And it's such a weird little look at that, and it's such a weird perspective on that piece of history. But then it goes away from that. It's not. It doesn't stick around. We have to follow the path of Tony Wilson, and he signs, you know, Happy Mondays, and is trying to make them a success. But also, he had, what was that? It was like a second band that Tony Wilson was managing that were kind of, he made them oil their legs and make them look more tanned and made them wear strange Boy Scout uniforms.
A certain
ratio?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes them a punchline as well. I thought that was really interesting that they basically just used them as a punchline, as a rubbish, poor imitation of anything Joy Division did.
Yeah, it's a shit because I don't know much about A Certain Ratio.
Feel bad, and that's why, because they weren't the geniuses, it seems. But I do feel bad as well, I guess. But yeah, you know, what do you guys want to talk about in the second part? What did you take away from the Happy Mondays story? Sean Ryder, his brother, Bez, all them.
Unfortunately, it made me like the actual people who were in the Happy Mondays less.
Well, they're just so that kind of irritating, like, young Manchester people who don't care about anything but a good time. And yet at the same time, all the way through the film is saying they're geniuses, they're poets, they're creatively something new and amazing and important, and yet, oh, you just stop poisoning pigeons, doing drugs, being irresponsible, you horrible jerks. Why are you wielding a gun at your own manager and getting 50 quid out of it? This, you are horrible, you know? Did you guys, Abby, you felt that? So.
Oh, I did. They were stuff that, well, they could have been lies. You got the feeling, they're not lying about this.
It's kind of, they must be based on actual facts. They might not be truly how it went down, but like, stuff like this must have happened. That kind of thing, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, just the going to, being paid to go and record an album, wasting all of the money and selling your clothes and doing everything you can because you're drug addicted and need to spend your money on the good times, and then handing in, you know, just the music element without any lyrics for your managers to deal with. And like, it's kind of, they're such a vexing band, and yet he doesn't say he hates them. He's always praising the Happy Mondays, and they kind of shed some light on how Bez is essentially nothing. Like, he was a reluctant addition because Sean Ryder liked him to the band, and all he does is just dance and is Sean Ryder's friend essentially, and is such a key part of the image of the Happy Mondays, and yet shows the success they had. They were important and successful. It's just they were also these fiends and scallywags that, you know, create kind of interesting dynamics on the screen and in the stories, whether it's like on the back of their tour bus or being absolutely inept in the studio, you know? Actually, some of the interesting things, I think, were the studio times, like you say, with Andy Serkis trying to record stuff. With both Joy Division and the Mondays, we get like weird ideas, like recording the drums and taking them apart and putting them on the roof and listening to them in the car to make sure, and then Tony Wilson making them listen to it in the car to make sure it's okay when it's going out on the radio. You know, what did you guys make of some of the studio moments?
It seems weird to me that was the first time I'd seen the joke of where they'd left the drummer on the roof.
Does that happen a lot?
I don't know, but it feels like an old joke, but I can't say if I've seen it anywhere else at the same time.
The Beatles played on the roof, but that was a sort of bizarre concert. But you hear these kind of myths and legends of, like, genius ideas where, well, maybe I'll play my guitar while I'm standing on tinfoil and that'll make it sound better. Although that could just be out of an episode of Daria, now that I think about it.
but there's moments. There's definitely loads of moments in this where it's kind of bringing up the age-old question of, like, the balance between kind of genius and crazy.
Mm.
And, like, it kind of pinpoints those little moments where you're unsure, where it's kind of, is this genius or is this absolutely loony kind of thing?
Yeah. And the movie kind of says, look, these guys are geniuses and artists, and they are important and to be cherished. But the real side of it is they are weird and mad, and they mess up their own lives, and, you know, they have all these problems. Like, and altogether, they're kind of a happy, dysfunctional family, these different bands and groups. And I think it kind of says, they're still artists and geniuses, but this is how they are. And it is kind of funny how ridiculous some of the situations get, whether it's, you know, Sean Ryder trying to rob his own manager and hold his own music as ransom for drug money. And, you know, it's just, you know, there's some great anecdotes portrayed in the film. And that's really what it's about, is a look behind the curtain and an anecdote, like, cavalcade, you know? And it's really interesting, I think.
Hmm.
What other bits did we have that are kind of worth talking about a bit? Because that's basically it, is the Happy Mondays eventually, you know, make enough money, but not enough to keep the Hacienda afloat because it just hemorrhages money. And they eventually have to say, that's it, we give in, sell the club we've bought, telling all the ravers to just take whatever they want and go, you know.
There's an interesting class moment that I quite liked. When the rival record company was coming in for the meeting, and they'd filled up the table with food that they thought that people from London would like.
Mm, the canapes and stuff.
basically all of the Happy Mondays were all like, what's this? This is rabbit food. I don't like it. And they don't like it so much, they just leave.
Yeah, it's almost that moment from Spinal Tap where it's like, what, this ham doesn't fit in this bread. Look, you fold it over and it breaks. Like, I'm going to get some fried chicken. You know, it's kind of, that's what it almost feels like at times.
Mm.
And then the record producer, you know, who does turn up to buy the stuff off them, realizes there's no reason to, because you don't even have a formal contract with it. Like, I don't need to buy any of these bands off you. So it is just, you know, a kind of sad tale of mismanagement ending up with all these, like Tony Wilson and the other managers he works with, sitting on the roof with, was it Sean Ryder in the end? Or
I think so, yeah.
They're just sort of on the roof and sad and just smoke some weed and like, and then weirdly, Tony Wilson sees God in the form of himself with a beard in the clouds, and he tells him that everything was worth it and all right, but oh well, kind of. But it's done wittily, and he kind of justifies it to, you know, his colleagues when he says, you know, basically, well, if it had been you, you'd have seen yourself, but it wasn't. It was me. I was God, you know. You know, so other parts then, because kind of, I think that's a really funny bit where you know, he sees himself as God, and it's almost, when he explains it, he still kind of arrogantly holds on to the idea that, yeah, when I saw God, though, he was me. Like,
when he was encouraging people to loot the
Hacienda.
Yeah, when it was getting repossessed, and he gave them very distinct directions of where to go in order to loot things.
Yeah, just directing them to the offices and stuff. Also, I do really like the relationship he had with his first wife/girlfriend thing, where he rather pathetically cheats on his wife, and then she confronts him while it's going on, and just the awkwardness in which he deals with it, and he's saying I love you, but also continuing after she's walking away upset with him, he continues with the situation. It's just like, you're such a low man, and yet at the same time you're pathetic, and I feel sorry for you.
There were a lot of, I was going to bring up, there's a lot of moments, the kind of like montage moments or kind of concert moments where it kind of takes a couple of minutes out to kind of really display the music that the film is about.
Yeah.
And I think, I suppose some people might call it a bit overindulgent, but I think it works to kind of, because it's more about the situation, the emotion and the feelings going on, and it kind of plays into that more than the plot. So I think it works.
And they're filmed in such a compelling way. It feels like you're actually at a live venue at times, because, like, for example, when Ian Curtis is, you know, doing his, like, turns up late, like Joy Division are playing and waiting for him, and they're just, and like John Simpson's character apologizes, and then, you know, he eventually turns up and starts singing and doing his weird, like, Ian Curtis, I'm having a fit dance. And sweating, and it kind of feels like you're in the front row a little bit. It's filmed in such an intimate dank kind of way. And then, but you know, they have other concerts and other moments that have a different vibe. Like, some of them are a bit more like full of hooligans, or like whether it's the raves where they're sort of mingle with the crowd as Steve Coogan walks in, and we kind of feel a bit more like they're surrounded by people dancing and on ecstasy and things.
I do have one kind of old man gripe with the film, I suppose. And it's to do with the kind of opening and closing credits.
Oh yeah.
Where I understand the style they chose, and it did fit in with it, but sometimes the credits were so kind of poor quality.
They're illegible.
That you're just kind of like, I can't read half of this.
It's to create that kind of acid, kind of cool colours and punk rock kind of vibe.
So I get why they used it, and it did work in that kind of way, but it just there were just moments where I felt a bit like an old grumpy man going, I can't read this nonsense.
But it's about setting atmosphere. I really like the opening credits because it's got the theme song 24-Hour Party People by the Happy Mondays, and it's the beautiful colours and amazing weird distorted graphics. It is illegible to sometimes, but it gets like the song is perfect, and it builds to the, like, it's the right setup to the right to the film, and it suits the film. And I think that, you know, you agree it suits the film. It's just, well, it should be legible, you know.
Like I said, old man gripes. I agree that it worked, and I understand why they did it. And it did definitely fit in with the aesthetic of the film overall.
Yeah. What do you think, Abby? Are the bits, are the things you want to bring up?
I don't think so. Because while we say that all spoilers are fair game on this, we genuinely don't want to spoil too many things.
And this, I can't. I must be other British actors I've forgotten were in it. There's so many. You go, oh, that guy. Oh, this guy's all right. You know, pretty much everyone in it looks like they wanted to be in it because they wanted, like, they liked this music, and they wanted to be in something this cool and in, you know, just to give me a little piece. It seems to be that even Rob Brydon was in it, like as some kind of ongoing, slightly a, like an agitated journalist who doesn't like Steve Coogan. I feel like they're riffing off each other a bit as well.
I literally just found out, according to IMDb, that John the Postman, who was the postman in that gig, was Dave Gorman.
Are you kidding?
That's what it said on IMDb.
I did not notice that one either then.
Well, he was kind of jumping up and down and flailing a lot, so because I suppose that you can get away with not recognising him in that one. But there was a small little cameo by Christopher Ecclescakes as a profound bum.
Yes, he kind of spouts some Shakespeare that... actually, that works quite well because Ecclescakes is sitting there as a bum talking about the highs and lows of life and how we're all on just a wheel. And that was kind of... And obviously, Tony Wilson took that to heart because it was like reflecting his life. He was at a low now, you know, and there'll be highs to come and there'll be lows, and accepting that there's ups and downs in life. And then when in one of his lows, he was presenting Wheel of Fortune, the... naff British game show with a colourful wheel where you win money, and he does the Shakespeare speech that Ecclescakes originally said to him, and what I love is that Tony Wilson is the producer of the Wheel of Fortune in their reality, and like says, oh, we'll just cut that and go straight to the show. You know, we're not going to have all that profound stuff at the top of like the Wheel of Fortune speech. We're not going to have that in. You know,
that made me feel sad about TV as well. Like, oh, yeah, people do that all the time. Oh.
But it's such a good joke because it's absurdly meta, because Tony Wilson is partly responsible for this story, and he's stopping himself ramble on poetically, and yet it's still in our film. It's kind of like wonderfully... And then they break the fourth wall and tell you, look, that's the real Tony Wilson. Do you know what I mean? And it's just... What? You know, it's great.
Yeah, and they start pointing out all the other kind of cameos in the film, even the ones that didn't make it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because, like, that's the other thing. It's not just British actors that are tremendous. It's, like, they have actual musicians, whether it's the guy from The Clash or Mark E. Smith is in the line, and then they point that out to you in the film in case, let's not just have Easter eggs. Let's point out those Easter eggs, crack them open, and eat the Maltesers within. You know? So it's just full. And then, Sean Ryder's brother, what's his name? The other Ryder.
Paul
Ryder?
Yeah, because he's in it playing one of the guys picking up drug money. I like, it was something about him. I was like, I'm sure I know who you are. I was like, oh, yeah, of course. It's like, you know, he's the guy from the Happy Mondays. I should have realised. And I think that's really, like, one of the strong points is how meta it is. Like, that's really something you either love or kind of go, how smug and pretentious.
Yeah, I think that was one of a real clincher for me. Was I was just enjoying how the kind of just knowing the whole film was. And it's just kind of like, yes, it's a kind of like, it's very core. It's a deceit because it's pretending to be kind of like this documentary kind of style. But then it's also being incredibly meta by also going like, actually, we're going to be really upfront with you. This is just a film. This is what we're doing.
And it suspects that you're a cynic because you like this music. You're probably a bit cynical, and therefore it's going to, you know, beat you to the punch to some extent.
So yeah, I think that's one of the kind of the big achievements of this film is that kind of element.
And it just adds to the humour. It creates a very humorous, it's almost like a full-on comedy if it wasn't, you know, full of sad tragedies and highs and lows, but it is funny all the way through. Thanks to everyone being kind of compelling and you know, funny.
Yeah, it's just, I think Abby said, it's just got, it's just such an incredible ensemble of, like, actors. It's almost a kind of microcosm of the actual kind of music phenomenon that was happening, because you've got all these kind of just hugely talented people all just kind of pooled together in Manchester. Mm. And then this film is just kind of crammed with all the kind of similar kind of British actors of the time.
It's almost all of the scene that was created in Manchester, the perfect way to represent it is to take the best and the people we cherish in British acting and comedy and have them tell the story. And that's that kind of work complements, you know, the story, doesn't it? Having all of these gems of British film and theatre doing their take.
Yeah. But, like, at the time, this was, like, 2001, all these people pretty much are still kind of, I wouldn't say underground, British underground kind of actors, but definitely kind of mainly kind of television and breaking out actors at the time.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it kind of parallels the Sex Pistols concert that they reference. And it's like, yeah, all these people aren't that big a deal now, but later on they'll be, you know, household names. Mm. And it's almost like this film managed to do that with little British actors, like, you know, because it's got Peter Kay, it's got Rob Ryden, it's got, you know, it's got Andy Serkis in it, it's got Simon Pegg briefly, and it's got loads of people who later on go on to bigger things from that, you know, to early 2000s on, and, you know, people who had already made it as well. Like, there's Paddy Considine has done some tremendous work. I mean, everyone in it, you kind of go, they've done some great stuff as well, haven't they?
Mm.
But yeah, we should kind of wrap up. I think we all very, very much enjoyed it.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It's a bit of a surprise. Like, Steve Coogan really kind of hits the right note, and that was the big kind of thing I had coming in. But that was not a problem at all. I suppose this was slightly hyped in my mind. I've only really heard good things about it. And I didn't, coming in, think that it would be my type of thing. But no, I ended up, like, really enjoying it and really kind of wondering about these people and wanting to know more.
Yeah. It's got a very British sense of humour, which I think helps. Just the stuff where the narration kicks in and it's like, if I had one regret, is I wish I should have signed the Smiths or stuff. And, like, it just, it makes you laugh enough so that you don't take it all too seriously as well. Because some of this stuff about musicians that are loved can be awfully poor-faced. Like, some stuff about the Beatles can just be, oh, they're such geniuses, but it's got no levity. It's just, everything's supposed to be important. It's too earnest. And it's just got enough kind of Spinal Tap style in there to make it fun.
Yeah.
So what can we rate it as, guys? Any thoughts? What summing up rating thing can we give?
Hard question.
It is. What defunct club? What particular track? What band? You know.
What factory?
What factory? Because it's Factory Records, and they keep calling their venues Factory. I like it as well that whenever the merchandise, like posters and tickets, is done, they're printed. They really like them, but it's like at the gig and too late, and that keeps happening. I really like that joke because I just like that idea. Like, oh, it's really good, but it's of no use. Like, well, we'll give them out. Yeah, still pretty rubbish, isn't it? Yeah, what factory? I mean, it's a really nice factory that's good, high quality. I don't know. Well, we kind of came up with our own metaphor that the British actors and, you know, talent involved with the film is a lot like the bands, like, to some extent.
I don't know if we can make this work, that it's a family that makes... Family? It's a factory that makes Betamax tapes. Because they had no way of knowing at the time that it just wasn't going to pan out and it wasn't going to work, that it was the wrong time in the wrong place.
And it's kind of like, Betamax was high quality videotapes and they were better than video to some extent, but for whatever reason, fate you know, dealt a different hand, and it was VHS tapes that made it for, you know, like industry, I think, used Betamax, but then the public didn't, and it just went that other way. So it is the antiquated failed technology, but it's still quite good. Like Betamax, probably, I haven't actually watched any Betamax. I hear it was a slightly higher quality tape. So it kind of works. Like, so it's a Betamax making factory. It's had its day. It failed. Actually, the film didn't fail. It was a great success. So, you know, we're stretching for metaphor here. any Anthony, what's in your factory, or what? Any thoughts?
I don't know where to go with this. I may have to turn in on this one.
Yeah, my one was a reach. It wouldn't surprise me if you just go, you know what, it's not worth the effort.
It is a factory that's been turned into a nightclub, because the factory has come and gone, the music has come and gone, the scene has come and gone, but it's been turned into a nightclub with the making of the film. So it's got a second life. This music, these people, ooh, have got a second life by it becoming a cool nightclub. And this film has, you know, brought a new generation to some old music. Because in a sense, it brought me to this older music for me. You know, it's kind of for people who grew up in that era to remember their youth and enjoy it and think about the ride they went on and how their youth was. But it's also, because it was made in the early OEs, it brought a new generation to that music after they'd, you know, missed out on it, essentially. So it's kind of like you're turning a factory into a music venue. And then, in this case, the music venue is awesome and keeps going and is worth watching again and again and worth going to again and again. It doesn't fail and get closed down or turned into something else. I think it works. So it's kind of like that, I would say.
Hmm.
Okay.
I like it. It's better than mine. Well done.
It is a Betamax factory that has become redundant but then turned into a swinging Manchester nightclub that's the hottest thing in town. Anyway, I think that'll do for our podcast anyway.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we're going to snap some glow sticks and no, we're not. We're just going to quietly get on with our day.
There's you.
Hallelujah, hallelujah, blah, 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 blah. I can't actually imitate Happy Monday songs very well. 24-hour party, people. It's not a one-man job, is it? You can't really karaoke dance music.
Can't.
Sad. Anyway, time to go. Bye.
Goodbye. Bye.